Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my two partners. There is Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hello.
And Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hey.
This is a movie review podcast. Today we'll be reviewing Blue is the Warmest Color, filmed by Abdellatif Kechiche, which won unanimously the Palme d'Or at this year's Cannes International Film Festival. Before we get into that, we'll actually be talking about previous Palme d'Or winners. What are some of our favorites? What are ones that we think maybe were a little misguided in their acquisition of said prize? After we get done with both of those, we will be giving you our best bets for things coming out to Blu-ray and DVD in the week ahead, as well as theatrical releases, and then we will give you a random recommendation of something that we have watched on our own. For anyone just joining us for the first time, if you have anything that you'd like to say to us, any comments or statements that you'd like to make in addition to what we've said, you can always email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. You can also go to thefilmstage.com and find the post that this podcast was posted under and leave a comment on that. We also encourage anyone and everyone to go to iTunes and give us a comment and a rating. That helps not only to spread the word about the show, but it also helps us to know what we're doing right and what you would prefer that we work on a little bit. Because we're not perfect, except maybe Danny. But we can't all be like Danny. Isn't that right, Danny?
Yeah, nah. I'm sorry, you guys, that you can't be perfect.
It's
but
okay. You set a high bar, but it makes us strive to better ourselves.
Yeah. So listeners, I mean, yeah, please do chime in to help these guys.
All right. Well, now that we're done with that, let's get into the podcast proper, and let's talk about the Palme d'Or. This is the Golden Palme. No one ever calls it that, though. And it is the highest award handed out at the Cannes International Film Festival. It has been around in one form or the other since 1939. At two points in its history, it's been called the Grand Prix du Festival International du Film. I think we all can understand why they would shorten it down and bring it back to Palme d'Or. So let's talk about some of our favorite movies that we've seen that have won this honor. Let's see if we can kind of use that to extrapolate what we think makes a Palme d'Or winning film. And then we'll talk about one or two of the films that we've seen that we just cannot understand how they won the award. So, Danny King, why don't you kick us off? Why don't you give us just a couple of your selections that you think are Palme d'Or winners that you've seen that are actually worthy of the honorific?
Oh, wow. That's quite the question. Well, you know, I guess I can list some Palme d'Or winners that I really like. It's probably hard to say if they, you know, technically deserved it completely because I probably haven't seen every film that was ever nominated for a Palme d'Or. But, you know, I can name some titles.
Okay.
Certainly Taxi Driver, Scorsese.
Of course.
New York.
Oh, that too.
Yeah, De Niro. quite the film. Apocalypse Now. That's, you know, that's up there. One film that I wouldn't say is one of my favorite Palme d'Or winners, but it sort of represents kind of this idea that a lot of the Palme d'Or winners are like, quote, controversial films, is the 1987 winner Under the Son of Satan. And it says on Wikipedia that that was a unanimous winner, which is kind of interesting, because there's a famous like anecdote about when that movie won, and the director Maurice Pialat went to accept his prize and he got booed. And he just said something to the crowd that, like, if you don't like me, I can tell you that I don't like you either.
That guy is now my hero.
Yeah. So he has a cool reputation of being like a very aggressive kind of guy, and that sums it up pretty well. So I think that's a good story if you want to get an idea of kind of sort of like this mythic quality that the Palme d'Or winner could have possibly. But some other winners that I really love. In recent years, the Dardenne brothers, who Their most recent film is Kid with a Bike, but they won 2 Palme d'Ors in 99 and 2005 for Rosetta and The Child. I'm just going to leave the French title alone on that one.
You're not going to call it L'Enfant?
L'Enfant. very French. But yeah, I love their films, and I think both of those are very deserving of that honor. Certainly in general, like, in terms of the titles that I've seen, it skews more towards contemporary winners. Looking back a bit, like one of my favorite films, The Third Man, that seems like a deserving winner. And Rome Open City, it's another good one. So yeah, those are some of like the older titles I've seen, but definitely need to catch up with a lot of the winners from yesteryear.
All right, Nick Newman, what about yourself?
Well, Danny, they're all technically winners from yesteryear.
That is, if we're going to be technical about it.
So, like, maybe yesterer year?
From past decades.
Okay.
Historical past winners instead of just past winners.
Okay. Anyway. Well, now that we've cleared that up.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick. That was, someone was going to email us about that, so I'm glad we headed that off.
I feel like it's interesting how the list of Palme d'Or winners, I feel like, actually doesn't do an entirely competent job of providing a litmus test for cinema that year. Looking at some of these winners, I find that perhaps their influence and the impact they had on film culture worldwide is not as massive as the Palme d'Or, its title and its reputation would necessarily suggest. Just look in recent years, I think, for a better example, The Pianist, for instance, mm-hmm. which I think is a great film, but I don't know exactly how much that had an impact on the world of cinema, really. Or for instance, Fahrenheit 9/11, which couldn't even influence an election. So if it couldn't do that, what other reaches it going to have? Then there are other winners, like 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, which really brought the Romanian New Wave to the forefront of cinematic discussion. I would also say that, for instance, Rosetta, which kind of, which helped make stars of the Dardenne brothers.
Yeah. Love those guys.
Mm-hmm. Or I think also Pulp Fiction, too, which is perhaps... I would say Pulp Fiction is the most influential film released in my lifetime.
I would agree with that. And not necessarily in a good way.
Not necessarily, no. As I said on a previous podcast, it has inspired some of the worst films ever made. So,
but it also inspired Suicide Kings, so.
I've never even seen that.
Oh, okay.
So, if you reach a bit further back, you look at some of the titles which have won. Like, it's interesting that MASH won the Palme d'Or. You wouldn't really think that necessarily. And I'm not really, I can't say for sure what significance that holds for the film or the prize itself. I mean, I don't know who thinks of MASH as a Palme d'Or winner necessarily.
No one.
Yeah.
It's a popular film, but if you were like, oh yeah, Palme d'Or winning MASH, they'd be like, what?
Mm-hmm. and yet I'm still looking at this list and it's still a very impressive, varied selection because, from, let's see, 1993, the winners were from the United States, Denmark, China, and New Zealand. The lattermost year was a tie between Farewell My Concubine and The Piano. It really does run the gamut of international locations there, because technically Blue is the Warmest Color counts as a Tunisian film, which is fascinating. Yeah, this was their first win, as I'm seeing here. And a few years ago, Uncle Boonmi won. That was from Thailand. It was Romania, it was Belgium. So I think that more than anything, the Palme d'Or has a significance as something that can shed a light on further corners of international cinema, which isn't to say that a film like Blue is the Warmest Color was really going to have a ton of trouble getting itself noticed. Because, it is a French film, which kind of puts it at the forefront more than most other foreign nations, actually, in terms of exposure. And it features at least one person who's, you know, it features someone who was in the most recent Mission Impossible film. So a film like that does not necessarily need full exposure. And in some sense, perhaps...
Oh, I just noticed that.
Yeah.
You said that and I was like, wait, who? And then all of a sudden it clicked in my head. I was like, holy shit, that's where right, I remember her from.
She was also the farmer's daughter in the opening scene of Inglourious Basterds too, which is weird.
That is weird.
Yeah, so she's kind of been around. But at the same time, what's interesting is that Blue is a Warm's Color might have actually been better off if it never won the Palme d'Or, because not only does it set expectations that are difficult to reach, but it also gives it exposure that the movie maybe doesn't need.
Right.
And that exposure reveals that the three main forces behind the film are all crazy. So, and Danny, I also want to bring up some of the other controversies around it are interesting, because you mentioned Under the Son of Satan. Only 3 years later, David Lynch's Wild at Heart won the Palme d'Or, and that's supposed to be one of the most volatile receptions ever, where actually at its ceremony, it was, I guess the room was divided between people who were booing loudly and people who were cheering loudly. Apparently Roger Ebert was leading the chorus of boos, which is kind of funny. and I guess that... To me, what's exciting about the Palme d'Or, in some sense, this might sound kind of silly, but I do mean it, is that when a film does win, a movie like Uncle Boonmi can get mentioned on CNN. You see, even if it's only briefly, it is giving it a platform which, you know, certain other award ceremonies would never ever give, and that is a good thing when these films can get just the slightest bit of mainstream spotlight. So that to me is the bigger impact, not so much the films that are going to come after it. I think that's actually a rare case. I'm not really sure what movies Blue's the Warmest Color will inspire. It doesn't seem like it's going to just stick in that way, but that's not necessarily a slight against the film, more just an observation.
Very good academic breakdown, Nick. I have to agree with basically everything you said. I'm still trying to get over the fact that she was in Mission Impossible. That's Lea Seydoux?
Yes.
Maybe? Sure? Why not? Okay. That's crazy to me. I had no idea.
Although she performed just as much cunnilingus in that movie, too, which is really surprising.
Yes. Yes, she did. I don't even know how to respond to that. As for things that I've seen, I mean, I'm kind of with Danny in that I've kind of been getting the most of my Palme d'Or exposure in most recent years, so I've just been kind of chasing whatever's happened most recently. Seen a lot of them on accident. MASH, for instance, I had no idea won the Palme d'Or. I didn't know Paris, Texas had won. I saw that. Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Barton Fink.
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now. I didn't realize that.
Okay.
Wait, you didn't know that?
I don't know if I knew that, yeah.
Oh, man, no, that's part of, like, it's part of its historical
place. I know he took it to Cannes in a slightly unfinished version. I didn't think I realized it had won the Palme d'Or.
Yeah, because it was, like, that was, like, the thing. It was, like, years of torment, and he almost went insane, but then it was amazingly successful, and it won the Palme d'Or, and blah, blah, blah. Brief Encounter, I didn't realize had won. I think I knew that Blow Up had won. Black Orpheus. Apparently in the 50s and 60s there were a lot of, there's just like suddenly a string of unanimous victories. That's pretty weird. And the Third Man, of course. But I
really
didn't realize the Third Man had won.
Yeah, really quick. I also think Third Man, I mentioned that too, but it looks like that might have like won something before the Palme d'Or was
kind
of invented.
Yeah, that's the Festival International du Film.
Yeah,
I'm gonna count that. Basically, things that have won the Cannes Film Festival, I feel like, fall under that. So I mean, that's why they don't say Palme d'Or winner. It's like won the Grand Prix. But I mean, I had no idea that it went there and won. Obviously, in the last couple of years, actually, I haven't seen Uncle Boonmi, which I feel, God, I'm pulling a Newman today. I feel like Uncle Boonmi is a big blind spot, because I remember hearing a lot about that. But other than that, I've seen a lot of the most recent ones, including Elephant, which I quite enjoyed. And again, I think I knew somewhere in the back of my head that had won. But seeing it here is still a little bit of a shock. Since, as Nick brought up, you don't see too much. I mean, like, you didn't see a lot of elephant clones after it won. I mean, aside from exposure, I mean, what do you think what do you think the motivating factor behind the win for some of these is? Is it like chasing a cultural zeitgeist? Is it purely based on a kind of vacuum viewed artistic merit? Because I mean, if you look at stuff like let's look at a string of winners from recent history. 2002, The Pianist. 2003, Elephant. 2004, Fahrenheit 9/11. 2005, L'Enfant. 2006, The Wind That Shakes the Barley. 2007, four months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. I mean, can you connect those in some way to one another? Is it like a social consciousness
award? I mean, don't forget that each year is a new jury.
Okay. I will forget that.
And it is hard to gauge the taste of someone on the jury. Like, Nicole Kidman and Ang Lee were on this year's jury. Like, can you tell? I can't tell you what movies they like, really. And it was led by Steven Spielberg, which actually led a lot of people to think that a different film was going to win. Father Like Son, which is a Japanese film about parental things, which, you know, is an interest of his, certainly.
Steven Spielberg is obsessed with father-son relationships.
I guess he really wanted it to win, but apparently this was a unanimous decision, so I don't know. I don't have much of an answer. I know that Fahrenheit 9/11 was actually not Quentin Tarantino's choice. I think he wanted Oldboy to win, but the other members just kind of went with that, so... He's actually said in recent years he doesn't regret being part of a jury that gave it that award. I don't know if there's like a much debate inside behind closed doors on the matter.
I've forgotten that it won.
Yeah, sorry. Hi. And I think that the sort of decision making process is something which, really, without knowledge of it, you kind of can't, like most things, without knowledge of it, you can't really say much because it is sort of this very cloudy thing. Okay. What is, you know, how does Ang Lee differ from Lynn Ramsey, who's also on the jury this year? I don't even think their films would necessarily tell you how they differ. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay, well, let's close this out now that we've done a quick trip through Palme d'Or history and our personal feelings about some of the winners.
They covered all the Palme d'Or history.
Yep. I said brief trip. It wasn't exactly... Anyway.
In 2004, Shrek 2 was in competition.
Are you fucking with me?
No, I'm serious. Along with the Coen brothers' Lady Killers.
I feel like weird. The Coen brothers are one of those people where it's like, you just kind of assume that they're going to be there.
Yeah.
Actually, Barton Fink won... They swept that for Palme d'Or, Best Director, and Best Actor.
Wow,
so it's kind of like, you know, Spielberg was like, you know, I got to be so cool. I got to give them all the Palme d'Or. Can't just give them the individual awards like Barton Fink.
The same happened with Blue is the Warmest Color, didn't it?
Yeah, but the actresses actually got like Palme d'Or credit.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, it makes sense because they're in there a lot. I'm surprised. I just want to give a shout out to The White Ribbon. I really like that movie. Michael Haneke. Way to go. But let's talk about the one film that maybe we've seen that we can't understand. Like, on a personal level, you never would have thought that this would win the Palme d'Or. I'm going to go with The Tin Drum. Has anyone seen that?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Actually.
It is a crazy, crazy surrealistic film. It's based on a novel that I believe won... Oh God, what's it called? The literary prize. Let me look this up. Tin Drum. Do do do. Oh yeah,
Tin Drum. Do do do.
It won the Nobel Prize for literature. Mm. So I mean, apparently there's just something about this story that's amazing that's gonna win every award that it touches. But I mean, it's I hated it. I sat there just in like not. Not in shock, but more like boredom and complete misapprehension. I was like, what am I watching? So, I mean, Somewhere out there is someone who could explain the artistic merit of this story to me, but I just was completely lost. Danny or Nick, were there any that struck you as particularly baffling? Aside from maybe the aforementioned Fahrenheit 9/11?
I mean, that one makes a bit more sense because a lot of the jury, you know, hated the prior president, so they saw it and they're like, yeah! That movie's really boring, too, which is weird. that is kind of a baffling one. Dancer in the Dark, actually, that's a recent one I don't understand. A, because that movie's not good. B, because it's... I just don't understand how someone enjoys that movie. And I don't mean because of, like, Lars von Trier's, grandmother hat-wearing, provocateur. He always wears a hat that, like, your grandmother would wear, is what I'm trying to say. Okay. The film's just not very good. And it's not that interesting either. So that it won the Palme d'Or is really curious. I don't really understand where that would come from. Another interesting choice is Underground from 1995. Has anybody seen that movie?
I have not, no.
Okay.
No.
That's a long, difficult, really kind of somewhat crushing film that I guess maybe, I don't know, maybe that's sort of, but it's also weirdly funny too. It's a very unusual film. And although quite good, it seems like it would possibly alienate much of the jury at hand, especially because, you know, the year before they gave it to Pulp Fiction, the year after they gave it to Secrets and Lies, which, better films actually, but they're also more conventionally enjoyable. So it is strange to me that a movie like Underground is sort of sandwiched between those two. I like it very much, but I wouldn't think it would get the sort of reception that would allow it to go that far. So those are two recent ones that kind of stick out.
And Danny King, what about yourself?
Well, I mean, I think one winner that sort of increased the exposure and was sort of the breakout moment of a really bad director is Sex, Lies, and Videotape. I mean, Steven Soderbergh is just like an awful director, and like without that Palme d'Or, we'd be saved all his films.
You want to be saved from Ocean's 12?
Yeah, that was a joke. I think one Palme d'Or winner that I just don't really like, and it's one that we've mentioned, is Wild at Heart.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I feel pretty comfortable in saying that's like one of my less favorite David Lynch films. Most of the other Palme d'Or winners I've seen, I'm positive on. And if I'm mixed on them, I probably haven't seen that much by the director. So I don't, you know, I might want to revisit it. But Wild at Heart.
No, stick to your opinion.
Well, Wild at Heart, I saw.
Through the consensus.
I saw that one recently and I was just like, all right, Willem Dafoe is pretty great. I don't know about everything else.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's our thoughts on... What was that?
So they should have given it to Firewalk with Me 2 years later.
Yeah. That one... I actually saw them on the same day.
So. Oh, wow.
That was a weird day.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's what we thought on Palme d'Or winners. If there are any Palme d'Or winners that you think are outliers, perhaps lacking in quality, give us a comment or shoot us an email at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Otherwise, let's get into our primary review of this year's Palme d'Or winner, and that is La Vie de Adèle, or as its English title is, Blue is the Warmest Color. And this is a film directed by Abdellatif Kechiche, and starring Léa Seydoux and Adèle Exarchopoulos. So Blue is the Warmest Color is the story of Adèle, who is played by Adèle, playing Adèle, and her sexual awakening and kind of flourishing into womanhood. That's about it for plot. The movie is very much an exploration of character. And she spends the bulk of the movie with Léa Seydoux, who plays Emma, who is another woman that she meets. Is that a lot of plot to go around in this? There's a lot of stuff that happens, but I mean, it's not that difficult to say. It's just about two women who fall in love and the way their lives are changed. So let's talk about it. This movie won the Palme d'Or unanimously. Obviously, it's got some bona fides to it. So, Nick Newman, what did you think of Blue is the Warmest Color? Which I guess we should just immediately say there was controversy around this film. There's like a 10-minute sex scene. And it's 3 hours long. So, Nick Newman, what are your thoughts on Blue is the Warmest Color?
Well, in regards to it being 3 hours long, that's not a deterrent for me. I don't mind long motion pictures. In fact, there's nothing I like more in the cinema than a well-paced, sort of compelling long film. To me, that's always a great achievement.
I love luxuriating in a long film. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing better than that.
And I think this movie, it's an interesting case because I think the film does a rather efficient job of moving along for its 179 or so minutes. And I think that I didn't think to myself, oh, God, where are we getting out of here? I wasn't getting restless physically or emotionally or mentally. I was pretty content. But at the same time, content is about... It's usually where it goes for me with this film. I did like it. I did purely like it. But there is sort of the problem, I think, with a film of this sort, a 3-hour Palme d'Or winner. I think there are certain expectations that come saddled with that. And although they are, in some sense, good expectations, they're difficult to live up to. And I feel like this movie doesn't have enough to really facilitate, really to earn the extents to which it decides to go, both in terms of length and in terms of content. While I am very impressed with the lead performance of Adele Exarchopoulos, and I think that Léa Seydoux acquits herself rather nicely. She's actually almost unrecognizable from her prior roles. There is something about the movie which I guess feels a little... How do you say it? Something about the movie which feels almost kind of familiar. And I have to ask myself how much of this I haven't really seen before to some extent done better. A coming-of-age tale, I guess literally a coming-of-age tale.
Yay.
And and there's also this controversial aspect of the extended sex scenes, which... although they're quite nice to watch, I do think they, if you'll allow me, I do think they are kind of unnecessary and they do feel kind of
gratuitous.
Strange. A bit.
I think it was Roger Ebert who once said that it's very rare that you'll run into a sex scene that could not be replaced wholly with a title card that just says, and then they had sex. And so whenever I see a sex scene in a movie, I try to think... if there is something about the scene or something that the character is doing within the scene that really sets it apart from just a title card that says, and then they had sex.
Mm-hmm. See, I think the sex scenes are important to show because it's about not only a discovery, but it's about a discovery which is not so common. And for that, yes, but the length of it and the gratuity of it, and how should we say the variety of it, it does feel a bit much. And I don't want to get into the whole discussion of I'm not even going to say the two word term that's been thrown around by so many people who once picked up an article at the Age Read for class on gender and film. It rhymes with fail raise, I guess.
Stale maze,
yes. I'm not going to say it, but the question of it is an interesting one. And I mean, the movie makes a motif of the girl Adele's behind. It frequently makes that a visual motif. And the question of why it is there and sort of why the director's chosen to focus on it, doesn't, I'm not sure, because the film is taken from her perspective, yes. And, but I do have to wonder, like, there's something about it which makes me a bit uncomfortable. And although, as a man, I did enjoy it, pardon me, I'm only human, I also just feel that maybe he could have cooled off a bit. I mean, the extent to which it goes in its more intimate moments is very extreme. It's probably the most extreme thing I've ever seen in a feature film. And so it's, but the rest of the film, I guess there's something about it which feels a bit, although it is good, it also just feels very, it feels strangely comfortable. And I don't know if I want a movie like this to make me feel comfortable. I feel like I have seen this kind of story. Again, I feel like I've seen this kind of story before, even if this is doing it from a homosexual angle. So it is a good film, but maybe, the whole 3-hour Palme d'Or winner thing set up certain things for me, which I can't exactly get past. And I know, review the film, not the story around it, but I don't know. Sometimes that kind of influences me a bit. So,
no, I mean, I can understand that. I mean, you hear Palme d'Or winner, and when we've had a string of winners like we've had recently, I mean, you start to really let that define a film for you. I mean, like, none of all the ones that I've seen recently, I've fully agreed with. Things like Moore, The White Ribbon, The Wind That Shakes the Barley. I mean, they seem to be on a roll. So I heard this one, the Palme d'Or. I was like, there must be something really, really special about this. I was expecting, you know, broad sweeping social commentary. I was expecting epic scope. I was expecting fierce intimacy with a character's psychological being. And what I got was basically Goodbye First Love with lesbians. Which, I mean, you know, isn't a bad idea for a movie.
No, it is not.
But here's the thing. So I was talking to a friend before I went and saw this, and I said, it's a 3-hour long movie. And, you know, I'm hoping that it has something more than just a relationship at the heart of it. I'm hoping that it really does do something more, because, you know, I wouldn't watch a 3-hour movie about a heterosexual couple if it didn't have other stuff. And unfortunately, you know, just switching up the gender roles, for me, it doesn't feel as revolutionary as it might have, like, 10 years ago. So I was like, it can't just be about the fact that they're lesbians, right? Because that was kind of the thing. It's like, oh, it's a lesbian film that won the Palme d'Or. I was like, no, there's got to be more to it. I'm just assuming that this is the media, just, you know, reducing it down to a hotline that'll sell tickets. And it really is, you know, there's not even a lot of, like, social commentary on homosexuality. Like, there's, like, one scene where there's some fighting about, you know, her possible sexual orientation. There's, like, one awkward scene where her parents obviously don't know what's going on. And then other than that, I mean, nothing. It literally just becomes like this weird semi-character drama about two women who are in love and have a pretty, like, bump-free relationship until later on. Like, it's just, there's not, people make a big deal about the 10-minute sex scene. There are a lot of 10-minute scenes in this movie. There are scenes that go on for quite a while, and some of them I find very effective. Such as Emma and Adele's first meeting in a bar. And then there are some scenes that I found a little less effective. For instance, Adele going to the beach. Adele's birthday party. And these are all scenes that last just about as long as the sex scene. And they kind of try to give it a scope. They have them go to a rally at some point, and, you know, they show the difference between Adele's parents and Emma's parents, but that felt a lot more like this weird elitist looking down on the lower class idea than anything else. And there's nothing particularly standoutable about this movie. Like, nothing that really grabs me and says, like, this is important, this is why this is, like, meaningful. And I don't know. At a certain point, I really started to just be like, this is it. This is all I'm getting. I have to be invested in these two. And I don't even know if I'm supposed to want them to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Like, it's not terrible. It's not bad. It's well acted. The directing is fine. But it's one of those movies where the direction seems to be, let's zoom in really close. People will assume that I'm getting this close so we can see all the nuances of their face. And then, sex scene, let's do a wide shot.
Yeah, wide shot.
It's not really problems, it's just like, it's just fine, it's just okay. And at just okay, I don't think you've justified the amount of time that I have to stay with these people. Because it's not like Lawrence of Arabia. It's not like, fuck, I don't know, name another 3-hour movie and it was probably fine.
At Berkeley, 4 hours.
Jesus, I don't know. I saw a preview for that. It did not look like it appealed to me. Because the last thing we need is a self-celebration of Berkeley.
It's a 4-hour documentary about UC Berkeley.
Yeah. I'm sure that we'll talk about that and we'll rave over it. I don't know. I don't... Just... Like, if you're having a 3-hour movie, like, let's just agree. Movies are usually between 1.5 to 2.5 hours. So if you need that extra 30 minutes... It's gotta mean something. You need any movie of any length has to justify its length by using that length efficiently. And I defy someone to look at this movie and say that every single moment was necessary. And when that happens at this length and with that much frequency of just poorly used time management, I guess, it gets rough. It starts to get rough at points. And towards the end, probably the last half hour, there were numerous shots where I was like, if it ended here, I'd be fine. If it ended here, I'd be fine. And I don't feel like it ends on a note that's particularly different than any of those other endings would have been. This is literally one of those movies that could have ended at any moment in the middle of it, and I feel like I would have gotten out of it what it wanted me to get without having to sit through the other hour.
Right. I will say that you talk about that movie doesn't make a big deal about the homosexuality. That's something I actually appreciated, because I guess I'm a bit... I find myself a bit kind of, I don't know, I feel like by now there should sort of be a movement toward a depiction of homosexuality in film that depicts it as a romance,
yeah,
first and foremost, and not something that's, you know, strange or dangerous or anything like that, which isn't, of course, to suggest that for some people, you know, it isn't, unfortunately for some people, it still is a dangerous thing,
right.
But I do think that there should be at least some kind of movement toward depicting a homosexual relationship as a relationship first and foremost. And that's one of the things I actually appreciated about the film, was how it sort of backgrounded some of the potentially controversial aspects of that and foregrounded just sort of the emotional heights, lows. So,
but that's like I was saying, it's like Goodbye First Love, but with two women.
Mm-hmm.
And I found the same problem with Goodbye First Love. You know, it went on too long. Like, there was too much stuff happening. Like, it made its point and it could have left. And I don't know why it decided to continue to luxuriate in this story, especially padding it out the way it does.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree to a point with you, but I'm not going to sit there and watch a movie about any person who's just like, hey, this is a relationship, and it's over. Like, that's not... I get in a very general sense, that is not something that would appeal to me. Man and woman, man and man, woman and woman, woman and a man, it doesn't matter. If there's not something intrinsically interesting about it, I'm not going to be able to watch it. And this movie doesn't have, like, an arc. It's just... it's like floating on a very lazy river. And that's fine. It's a good way to spend an afternoon, I guess. But it doesn't leave me feeling particularly fulfilled or enlightened. I didn't learn anything or gain anything from this movie. I wasn't moved emotionally. And so it's enough to say I sat for 3 hours and looked at flickering images on a screen and it was fine with it. But I just kind of wanted more.
No, sure.
Danny King, what about yourself? What do you think of Blue is the Warmest Color?
Nick, were you talking about male gaze earlier?
Fuck. Brian, edit that out.
I'm just gonna put a. I'm gonna put bleeps on it.
Male gaze, right?
Yeah, male gaze.
All right, so I think I kind of fall in line with the other two opinions presented here, in thinking this is a nice film, if not a particularly transcendent one or whatever. I think that I kind of agree with Nick in that I welcome the lack of kind of social consciousness, and I actually think that when the movie tries to go for those things, it's at its worst. Like, I really dislike the scenes with, like, her girlfriends at high school.
Yeah,
and, like,
that was such a weird insert that never gets revisited again.
And, like, when they...
insert.
When they were...
Damn it, Nick. We're trying to be respectable here.
When they were saying things to her, like, cursing her out and stuff for hanging out with this other girl, I was like... I mean, I didn't even know if that was... realistic.
It doesn't feel like it.
It's it was like, very strange. It feel, I feel like if this movie took place in like 1997 or something,
yeah,
it might
yeah.
be a bit more. But I mean, I'm not really sure what the social situation is in France with regards to perceptions of homosexuality. But it was it, even then, it felt very sudden and kind of yeah. so forceful too.
Yeah, and it was, and again, like it wasn't. There wasn't a. It was just like, oh man, you held out with a girl who looks kind of like Butch. So I'm gonna yell at you now about how that we've like slept naked together before.
Yeah,
and it's like, I mean, it was just one girl. It seemed like the other girls were kind of like, you know, why don't you just tell us what's going on? Like normal, I'm your friend, tell me shit type of situation. Mm-hmm. But that one girl was like pretty damn angry about it, and
yeah,
it
like,
did feel really forced.
That's a scene that could have been. You know, one of your 10-minute scenes that could have been cut down.
It could have been cut completely because yeah. it doesn't do anything. Like, I was expecting at her birthday or something, someone to say something in front of her parents, or nothing ever comes back.
Yeah.
This woman's life happens in momentary vacuums that seem to have little to no continuum within the rich tapestry of her life, except for the fact that she's dating Emma.
Yeah, and actually... I would have welcomed more of the like parental scenes. I thought those were interesting, even if they are a little bit like sort of class commentary. But I think they are kind of revealing of each of the characters.
You finish your thought, and then I'll talk about the parent scenes because that's what really bugged me.
All right, well, that'll be interesting. But I think it's like weird for a 3-hour film that's been generating a lot of controversy, just kind of like how conventional it is and pretty standard. And I think there's an admirable sort of ambition in this idea to almost shoot this whole film in close-ups. But I mean, I would say that there were like barely any interesting images in the movie that were the result of like whatever Kashish was going for. I mean, I think the lead performance is amazing, and part of the reason why the movie moves so well is because you just kind of get lost in her performance. But I don't think that anything he was doing was particularly interesting, and I'd like to see his previous films because it seems like there might be some more going on there purely in terms of direction. But yeah, on the whole, this was like a nice film that happened to be 3 hours and happened to win the Palme d'Or. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's what... I think, Danny, that you've given this the perfect box quote. It's like that happened to be 3 hours and happened to win the Palme d'Or.
I'm sure they'll be in touch for, like, the Criterion cover.
Yeah, and this is going straight to their Criterion collection, so... I mean, okay, so here's my problem with the parents. Because the movie, again, it doesn't say a lot. Like, you got that one angry girl, and that's about it, until you get to the parents. And the parents of Emma are upper class. You know, they've got paintings. They go to a market to get fresh oysters. They're very cosmopolitan. And, you know, when her daughter walks in with a young woman who's now her partner, they say, you know, oh, let's toast to love. And then you go to... Adele's parents, and they're not like bad. Like, it's not like, you know, oh, you know, don't we hate the queers. It's they just live by, you know, traditional norms of gender roles and thinking and heterosexuality. The heteronormative paradigm is embodied in these people. And the scene is treated with this kind of weird condescension towards them. Like, they ask about Emma's boyfriend, and then they say, you know, well, it's, you know, you got to have a man to make money if you're going to be an artist, because they obviously live in a state of less economic certainty than Emma's parents. And it's kind of like, oh, these poor people who have to worry about money and live by traditional gender norms because they're not artists who can live in a stylish flat and have gallery showings. Like, that's... It's a little... I don't like it. I don't like that. I don't like that condescension. That really set me off for a little while. I was sitting there in the film. I was like, really? You can't just... You're not even going to, like, have them be, like, finding out about it? I don't know that they ever knew. I feel like they just left at some point. And it bummed me out that they were given this, and they weren't even given the opportunity to show that they could expand their horizons, or they were going to keep closed off. Like, they weren't given any agency. It's like, let's just talk about their silly little lower-class lives.
Although they do serve a metaphoric purpose, because her parents, Adele's parents, serve the pasta.
Yes.
And what's the name of the other girl again?
Emma.
Emma's parents serve the oysters. So, little metaphoric push-pull there, I'd say. Pastas or oysters, guys.
Okay.
I literally do prefer pasta, like, as a food.
Where
does that leave me? Pasta looks very good. It does. I didn't think the French could cook pasta, I have to be honest.
Yeah, he made a nice bolognese. Looked pretty good.
Yeah, it does.
There was more pasta in this movie than in any Italian movie I've ever seen, so make that what you will. One of the qualifications about how this movie depends upon the close-up is that you will see more people eating at more of an extreme close-up than you ever wanted to in your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you become very acquainted with people's mouths and teeth. I could pick out each of these actresses if you just showed me, like, their dental x-rays.
Mm-hmm.
Adele, I've said a lot of things that I didn't like about this film, or that I thought were lacking. I will go out of my way to say again that Adele and Leia, who play Adele and Emma, are very, very good in this role. And their first scene in the lesbian bar together is electric, and it's true to life, and it feels correct, and all of their interactions up to a point feel very real. It kind of got distracting how much Adele sort of looks like Kristen Stewart at times.
Say that again?
I think Adele looks a lot like Kristen Stewart at times.
I didn't notice that.
No, I didn't get that at all. No,
really?
Sorry.
With the eyes and the messy hair, and then the way her mouth is always open?
Sorry, bro.
Okay, it's cool. I might be the only one. There were numerous points in the movie where I was like, oh, this girl is Kristen Stewart's French cousin who has all the talent that Kristen Stewart never had. Like, they each had normal levels of talent, and then Adele just, like, vampired it out of Kristen Stewart. Not to be too mean to Kristen Stewart, I've liked her in a movie I've seen her in, so there's a possibility. But yeah, so I'll say again, they're very good. And, again, I admire, like, the normalcy that it treats this relationship with. It's kind of like when I first saw Brokeback Mountain. And obviously that movie has more to say on a social level. It takes place in the past, and their fear about being caught is very much a part of that film. But their romance is not portrayed as anything weird. You know, it's just normal. Like, as you would assume that any relationship in real life would be. It's just two people who love each other. And that works for me. I like it when things do that. I don't like things that draw a lot of attention to it. But again, like, 3 hours is 3 hours, and some of the choices in this film, completely unrelated to their relationship, crazy. Do we want to get into spoilers about this, to talk a little bit about how it ends and what we think it's trying to say in a broader sense?
Yeah, sure.
I mean,
yeah, sure. That would be fine.
Yes. Okay.
I will say that there are a few things I normally find more repulsive than watching somebody else eat food. Okay. Like I really just hate like watching somebody eat food. Yeah, but
this is not the movie for you then.
No, I was gonna say this movie was actually enjoyable because she has her adorable two front teeth.
Oh, her adorable buck teeth.
And I was like, ah, so cute.
Watching her bite into that gyro was the highlight of my day.
Yeah, it was very cute. So this movie does accomplish. This movie does make the consumption of food actually appealing, which maybe that's why it deserves to win the Palme d'Or, because it managed to do what's seemingly impossible.
And they chose like the weirdest, most messiest foods to have be shot in close up. It's not like a sandwich. Like, you know, a sandwich I'm sure would be fine, or like individual pieces of like a steak or something. It's like, what's the messiest food we could possibly choose? Well, we could do gyros. And oysters, and fuck it, let's just do spaghetti.
So I think it reflects character.
Obviously.
Could be going out on a limb there.
A little bit. So let's get into spoilers. We'll talk a little bit more.
Actually, it's a metaphor for the French-Algerian conflict. It's really weird.
It's very strange.
It's like cachet, but with food. And it's much, much more oblique. Much more oblique.
To the point where you almost wouldn't believe it.
Yeah.
So, spoilers for Blue is the Warmest Color. We're going to get into some plot points. Like I said, there aren't many plot points, but, you know, maybe, you know, this is whatever. Spoilers. There's not a happy ending, I guess, per se. Adele and Emma break up at the end because... And here's where it starts to get a little dicey for me. Again, just on a character level. Because Emma starts to withdraw emotionally and physically from Adele. And, you know, Adele kind of turns into the harangued housewife who, you know, sets up a giant party and does all this cooking and, you know, her wife slash husband partner. I'm trying to, you know, fit this into what would be a heterosexual story is like flirting with someone else the whole night. And at some point, Adele begins cheating on Emma with a man and Emma like flips the fuck out. And kicks her out of the house in the middle of the night. And that's the end of their relationship. They have like one or two more meetings that come to nothing. And Adele finally moves on. But I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Emma begin her relationship with Adele while she was with someone else?
I think she formed an interest. She was her eyes were caught while she was dating that douchey looking other guy.
It was what?
The douchey looking guy who has the band.
Oh, I'm talking Emma, blue hair.
Oh, blue sorry.
Was dating a woman named Sabine for 2 years when her and Adele met, and never make it clear when she breaks up with Sabine.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that I read it was that she was definitely still with her the first time that they had sex, and so I mean, like that's a pretty you don't really have a lot of moral high ground in that. You've done that. And also, you know, can't you look at yourself and say, like, yes, I have been... But then, so here's the question. Was she pulling away because she didn't love her and she wanted something like that to happen and she was, like, relieved that her trod-upon partner finally, you know, did something that was worthy of a break? Or was that actual hurt and pain?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you have an opinion on that?
No, I think that was genuine hurt. I do. I also think that maybe Adele, I think that perhaps Emma displays insecurities in that scene, the way she does react, and also sort of a closed worldview, because to her the idea of, I think just that naturally a closed worldview, because to her the idea of not only infidelity, but infidelity with a man instead of a woman is just this very confusing, shocking thing that can't really be understood in any conventional way. And I found that scene very, very moving, honestly, because the circumstances behind it are so unusual. And I think so. I don't know how often that happens. And I found the just sort of the storm of emotion. You know, forgive me for using such a generic stock word, but I found it powerful. And I think that Seydoux really sells that scene, as does Exarchopoulos. I thought that was their best scene together. I didn't really have a problem with the development itself. B, any problems that I may have had were sort of eclipsed by the results.
Yeah. Their acting in that scene was great. However, did you feel that the visual sense of the film kind of left that scene? It felt a lot flatter. It felt a lot more like reality TV-ish. To the point where sometimes it actually pained me. Like it was something about the lighting, I think.
Was there something wrong with your projection? I didn't notice.
Because the rest of the movie looked fine. But like that's what it felt like. Like it felt like in that scene, because they were ducking away from their close-ups, like maybe they didn't have time or energy to readjust. And so the added background and the lighting of an interior scene at night, like it just there it like maybe there wasn't enough shadow. Like I don't really know how to explain it. It just felt really weird and false. Not their acting, but the actual visual representation.
No, I can't really say so. I don't know about Danny, if he felt that way or
visually I don't really recall being thrown off by the scene.
Okay, I'm obviously just going crazy then.
Yeah, it could be you going crazy. But yeah, I would agree psychologically. I would agree with Nick's reading that it's kind of crucial that she was cheating on her with a man, because like I feel like the ending is actually like the most unconventional part of this movie, just in terms of how undetermined it is. And it really just leaves you hanging. Like there's really no sense of conclusion to the final shot for me.
A little bit, but we'll get into that in a sec.
Yeah, we can get into that. But I think that part of that is because, like, it really, Adele's sexual identity is still kind of up for grabs by the end of the film. And I think that's kind of what leads Emma to sort of break it off, is like she needs someone she can count on in that way.
But I mean, am I the only one who has a little bit of sympathy for Adele?
Yeah.
I mean, Emma has this party with all these people, and Adele does everything. I think that it was almost fairly obvious that Emma had fallen in love with that Lise woman, and that she was kind of... There's an excellent line in Mad Men when Joan says that, like, a man doesn't, like, take you to dinner to break up with you. He, like, just basically acts disinterested until you demand a statement of hatred. Does anyone remember that scene? Anyone watch Mad Men?
No,
it's
I don't.
Not really a spoiler. Anyway, that's a really insightful thing, because there are so many times when a guy will be in a relationship and he'll just kind of pull away and he will avoid or dismiss his girlfriend until she's basically like gone insane and is like, just tell me you fucking hate me so we can get out of this. Because he doesn't have the stones to actually just end the relationship. And that's what it really felt like Emma was doing at the end. And so I thought that she had already moved on, and she was just kind of waiting for a reason. And that she had found it, and she had used it. And that's why she didn't really seem too broken up about it when they met for coffee later. And you actually find out that, yeah, she did hook up with Lise.
Yeah, but she also says some stuff that, like, you know, are my new relationship isn't as, like, passionate.
Yeah.
But I definitely have sympathy for Adele.
Yeah.
So
here's
a
pro tip, though. Never say that to your ex. That was a terrible choice. So, I mean, like, things like that, I think, are where I find the interest in this movie. And one of the reasons why, despite my issues with its time, I might watch it again. Because I do kind of want to suss out things like that. But, again, it's something that could have been done in a shorter film. The final shot... Actually, no, let's stick on this for a second. So, we do find out that Adele has been cheating on Emma with a man. And here's where the question about the sex scenes comes up for me. Because we see Emma, or we see Adele with her first boyfriend, and they have sex. And it's pretty obvious that aside from a few physical responses that are probably more hardwired into the brain than the heart, She's not really enjoying it. Then we have the three or so sex scenes with Emma that are filled with reckless, uninhibited passion. I feel like, and this is going to sound weird saying it, but I feel like I needed to see her having sex with that man in order to really understand the nature of her affair. I feel like just having her say at some point that they've had sex two or three times, it doesn't work for me.
To be honest, I found the guy like so physically repellent that I thought to myself, I would probably turn to a lesbian. What's weird is that those two actors are actually dating in real life.
Wait, Adele and her first boyfriend or the guy she was cheating with?
The first boyfriend.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, hey, Adele, listen up.
I'm available.
So anyway, it's just kind of it's kind of it's a bit funny how the person who turned her, who may have turned her into a lesbian, she's now dating in real life.
Yeah,
in the film, I mean, not in real life.
But so, am I alone in that and feeling like, especially in a movie where they make a big deal about the fact that she's fallen for a woman, and that that's where she finds her bliss. I mean, for her to then cheat on her with a man, I feel like you could have cut out one of her lesbian scenes and put in a scene of her having sex with that man. Because that's one of those things where you can't just say, and then she had sex. Because you need to see the uninhibitedness with which she throws into it, or is she, you know, feeling bad about it? All of her sex scenes with Emma were completely naked. Maybe in this one, she only hikes up her skirt a bit. Like, there would be character moments within that affair that would inform what it is and what it means to her, more than just her saying it meant nothing. Because she could be lying, because she wants to keep Emma.
Yeah, I think that's actually a legitimate argument to make, because the movie does set itself up as, like, being directly about not only her general coming of age, but, like, specifically her sexual coming of age.
Right.
So I would, I'd agree with that.
Nick, any thoughts from you?
Well, maybe that's part of the problem with showing as much as you do during, because there's such an emphasis on the two women together. And then, yeah, there's not much male-female action going on here. And, it is a bit confusing. And I suppose one could, if they were generous toward the film, I suppose you could say, oh, well, this is an instance of kind of showing you the sense of discovery and then reverting sort of off-screen to something that's considered more normal. But I'm not sure if that's what the movie's actually doing is the problem. It raises questions of representation and subjectivity. And because it is from her perspective, I suppose it makes sense to be as in-depth with the sex as it is. But
not as in-depth with the sex with the person she's having an affair with?
Yeah, that is a bit... bit problematic, and it's not something I can really find much of a positive for.
Yeah,
I kind of want to defend that a bit, but I can't.
Well, to me, the only way to defend the amount of time spent with her first boyfriend, which doesn't work out, is to have that scene of her having the affair. I know it sounds crazy again, but I need to be able. If you're giving me this much information about her first boyfriend and their sex, and then her sex with Emma, and then you're just going to have her say in a throwaway line during a fight about her affair with another man, I need to see that in order to give me the symmetry of information that I need to really understand what was going on. I mean, her emotional devastation after Emma leaves is real, so it's obvious that the bulk of her emotions were still invested in Emma. But I still need that. I need that last key in order to help me really get a fully formed picture of what's going on. And it kind of bugs me that the movie, which is so bold, I guess, about showing her and Emma, can't spare 3 minutes to show the incitement or continuation of any kind of sex with the man that she's cheating on her girlfriend with. That seems to me to be an invaluable piece of the puzzle that I'm now missing. So that's my thought. The final scene of this movie, Danny said that it ends on a very inconclusive note. And she's at a gallery opening. She meets a guy that she had spoken with and danced with at the house party. And she leaves because she can't bear to continue watching Emma and her new girlfriend together. And the guy goes out to look for her, and he doesn't see her, so he goes the wrong direction after she's already turned down a side street. And then the sound of the steel drum that had been playing when her and Emma first saw each other crossing paths on a crosswalk is playing, which I guess ties into the opening scene, which is literally a classroom explaining the thing that's going to happen in 20 minutes, which is always a problem with me in a movie. The movie has a lot of heavy-handed things like that, and then has a lot of subtler things, which helps add to the unevenness that I felt in it. And that ending kind of made me cringe a bit. Any final thoughts on that? Anyone want to delve into that aspect? Did you think it was effective? Did this movie end effectively?
I found the setting of the final scene to be very effective, because there's sort of this very fresh, like almost like the start of spring aesthetic to it, when she goes to the gallery and whatnot. And something about that I actually found very kind of sad in a way, kind of the sense that there was this sort of this new beginning, but where exactly she's going to go from pinpoint. That to me, I don't know, it definitely worked. I wasn't left in tears by the end, but I did, I don't know, I guess I found myself a bit bummed out at the end of the film. And
the guy didn't find her?
No, not necessarily. The guy will find her, I'm sure. He can just, because realistically, he could just like ask somebody at the party where she lives and they'll tell him. If you think about it, like practically, he could find her pretty easily. No, not that. Just sort of the question of what the relationship was. It actually worth? What was it worth all the heartache? Which I think is a question that a lot of people ask themselves after the end of a relationship, rather when it ends poorly. I found its handling of that to be very, just conventionally, very traditionally, simply just moving. It might not get much deeper than that, but sometimes it doesn't need to. So,
I feel like, again, it needed something more. And I feel like the addition of that steel drum and that callback to the question of, like, love at first sight and what does it mean when you cross eyes with someone and then, like, leave. And then, you know, the guy's talking about regret at the hole in your heart that will never be filled and blah, blah, blah. But again, when you have a 3-hour movie, it's really difficult in the last second to call back to something that was literally happening in the first second. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there was a lot of meandering that went on that kind of blunts whatever possible message could have been there from that. Yeah, I got a problem with it. But in general, I'm, I give the movie about a C+, B-.
Yeah, I give it either a solid, really solid B or a light B+. Maybe a solid B.
Okay. Danny, what about yourself? If you had to give this a letter grade.
Well,
on a scale from 2 to 7.
5.4.
Okay.
Okay, sure. So that's it. That's our review of The Blue is the Warmest Color. There's a lot of stuff in this that we didn't have time to talk about. We didn't have time to talk about their meeting in a coffee shop. Didn't have time to talk about... God, I don't know. So much stuff happened in this. We hit the main points, though. But if you'd like to keep the conversation going, email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Blue with the Warmest Color is currently out in limited release, so check it out in a theater near you, hopefully, if you live in a major market. Let's move on. Let's talk about the things that are coming to Blu-ray and DVD. First of all, we have The World's End.
Oh, we reviewed that.
We did. We did review The World's End.
We did review that film.
So, what was that?
I said we did review that film. We're all in agreement.
Yes, we did. That's a film that we had some feelings on. I don't know. Should people buy it? I really have a lot of problems with the way that film ends that I almost break the movie entirely for me.
Well, A, you're wrong. B, yes, they should. I think The World's End is fantastic, and I also think it'll make a good, just a very, like Edgar Wright's other film, just a very replayable motion picture. And also, I imagine it looks quite beautiful on Blu-ray, too. So, yeah, I look forward to snatching that one up.
It's a well-made, hilarious film. The last, 98% of a great film, and then the last 2% poisons the well.
That's not true, listeners, but... Brian, you can actually buy it, and then you can just stop it.
I would love to be able to do that. And if I ever did buy it and showed it to someone, I would do that.
Oh, dear.
I gotta say, the end of that movie is... Anyway, people, we talked about this at length. You can listen to that podcast. I'll put a link to it right here. Also coming out, We're the Millers. Didn't see that. Did anyone see that?
No.
No, okay.
It's made a ton of money, though.
Two Guns?
Yeah, I saw Two Guns.
Danny, how was Two Guns?
These days in 2013, I will watch anything with Denzel Washington. but yeah, that movie's kind of like boring.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which was surprising.
But they're shooting guns back to back with money flying around them.
Yeah, there's not that much of that going on. That's like one shot.
I thought that was like the whole movie.
Hopefully. That's what I wanted the movie to be. But yeah, it's not that good, but Denzel, you know.
Okay. We also have Disney's Planes.
Paranoia.
Paranoia, yeah.
Jesus Christ. I don't think Harrison Ford even remembers that movie. This is kind of weird. It says that The Act of Killing is coming out, but I don't think that's true. I believe it's been pushed back to January, which is too bad. That might be sort of like an awards thing. But I should probably see it before I make a top 10 list, so.
Yeah, I need to see that too. That and Blackfish, I feel. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, in relation to The World's End, they're also releasing the Cornetto trilogy on a collected Blu-ray set.
Ooh.
I actually don't have those films on Blu-ray, so that might be a good purchase.
Yeah,
love to watch Hot Fuzz in 1080p, so.
All right.
Is Russian Ark coming out on Blu-ray too?
Is it?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Oh, I know where my money's going.
Then yeah, his new film just got released.
Oh yeah, well,
Faust.
What was it called?
Faust. Yeah, Faust.
Yeah, that's his. What are they calling? Speaking of trilogies, what are they calling that trilogy?
Yeah, it's some kind of trilogy. I haven't seen
it's
the
like
other.
The Sun, Faust, and oh god, starts with an M, I think. We're talking about Alexander Sakharov, anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about.
Yeah. But yeah, I've heard good things about Faust, even though it took like 2 years to get released.
What was I going to say? Oh, I want to throw out a really hearty recommendation for the third season of Treme. Does anyone watch Treme?
No.
Oh, okay.
What is it?
Treme is an incredible show on...
I've only seen the first season, fortunately.
On HBO. And it's about New Orleans recovering after Katrina. And it's got a stellar cast of characters from all aspects of life in New Orleans. It like basically follows the entire culture trying to come back and them basically deciding like how much of our past do we want to keep hold of and how much has to be raised in order to get ready for our future. And it's a really, really interesting, well-done character piece. There's not really a plot to it. I guess this is a good way to tie into Blue is the Warmest Color. There's not really a plot to it, but the fact that these people have a struggle, and because you get so invested in them, really helps to sell the fact that this is basically gonna... the last 5 episodes are coming out this December, I think, actually. They're giving it a final half season to wrap up all their storylines. I don't know what that means. I guess they're just gonna give them an existential conclusion. But, I mean, it's going to come out to basically a 36-hour-long movie about all these people. And, you know, it's not there's not really, like, a through line or a plot. It's not like The Wire where there's a murder mystery. It's just something interesting and something well-written and something that I think will end up one day being a very big cultural artifact for us. So, check it out. That and The Russian Ark.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on. Let's talk about what's coming out to theaters. November 22nd, the big, 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 big film of this year, The Hunger Games: Catching Fire, which is the follow-up to the smash hit The
Who's that the big film of the year for, besides
Do you remember how
children?
Much money The Hunger Games made last year?
No. I mean, sure, it'll make a lot of money, but I mean, like, who cares? Like,
apparently enough people to open up the last film to, like, $120 million.
Who's listening to this
show? Listening. We have many listeners.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not gonna be that guy who assumes that we're only being listened to by the intellectual 1%.
I thought the first Hunger Games was fine. Like, I'm not anti HG man. I'm just saying, like, I don't know. I'm just not sure who that's the big film of the year for that listens to this show is all. Okay. And holy shit, I keep forgetting. I just said this to someone 3 days ago and I keep forgetting that Philip Seymour Hoffman is in this movie.
Yeah.
And he's acting alongside Donald Sutherland, and I'm reminded that I kept saying when the trailers came out, because they're always featured together in them, if the movie was just a two-man film, Philip Seymour Hoffman and Donald Sutherland, like, talking to each other, I would just see this first day in IMAX. Unfortunately, that's probably not what this is.
Well, so. if you want that, check out Philomena.
Anyway, I was not a fan of the first Hunger Games. I felt like that movie, on both a story and a visual level, had a lot of problems. I can't say that I'm too excited about this one, but I'm vaguely interested because I like Jennifer Lawrence. Literally, probably the only draw for me. Though I have heard that this movie has a greater grasp on the larger cultural goings-on in the Hunger Games universe, which I think could be interesting. Okay, my problem with the first film... I had no idea what the hell was going on in the outside world, so I had a very hard time understanding most of what was supposed to be the societal impact of the games. So I feel like if you could flesh that out and really give me, like, a Battle Royale-esque universe with, like, outside stakes, I think I could be interested. Especially with Jennifer Lawrence in the middle of it all. So we'll see about that. That's what we'll be reviewing next week. We also have Delivery Man coming out. The Vince Vaughn remake of Starbuck, same director. Thoughts? I won't lie, the trailer is in the most bald-faced and obvious way kind of effective. But that's mainly because it's just Vince Vaughn doing his, like, hey, I'm a regular guy thing, and then, you know, saying something moving at some point.
Yeah, that's fucking insufferable. What are you talking about?
I don't think it's terribly insufferable. I think this might be one of the few films where he's used effectively.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting? If on Wikipedia you click... there's this part of Wikipedia where if you click the 2013 in film... list, which is usually where I look for new wide releases. If you click the director's name, Ken Scott, it actually brings you to the page of a British record producer engineer, widely known for being one of the five main engineers of the Beatles, as well as engineering Elton John, Pink Floyd, Procol Harum. Just like it's an interesting link mishap. So I was looking at this, yeah. I was like, wait. So the guy who's influential in the evolution of jazz rock directed Delivery Man.
what
happened there?
That'd be kind of crazy.
And then if you go to Delivery Man's page, there's a link to the actual guy. But anyway.
Excellent. Okay, so Hunger Games and Delivery Man. What can I say? See whatever one you think is going to fit you best. I'm really not the guy to tell you which among these is probably going to be better. But we will be talking about the Hunger Games next week. In the meantime, before we sign off, let's give our brief recommendation of something that we watched on our own this week. Nick Newman. What's something you watched on your own you think people should check out?
Let me load up my little film log here. Let's have a look at what was viewed this past week in cinema.
Cinema.
Yes.
Cinema. Do you cinema?
Yeah, sure. I'll go with Salesman, which is a... No.
Oh,
no,
wow.
I'm not going to go with that. I talked about a documentary the week before. Fuck it.
Jesus.
I'll go. No, it's good. It's good. But I already talked. I'll talk about Sancho the Bailiff, which is a 1954 movie by Kenji Mizoguchi. Do I need to tell you that he's Japanese or not? Fantastic movie. Also, probably the most emotionally crushing I've seen this year. Makes Blue is the Warmest Color look like looks like a less emotionally effective film, I guess. It's kind of a really strange film because narratively it seems to kind of it starts at sort of this very the way the film begins is this very momentous event, and it kind of splits from there in about four different directions, and it kind of keeps splitting. Perhaps, in my opinion, not always in an entirely cohesive way, but the way it kind of brings itself back, the sort of the structural gambit of the movie, the way that it ties everything back together, was quite a pleasure to watch. And of course, I mean, Mizoguchi, I feel like there are few directors who can use a frame as effectively and use the objects inside a frame with the same impact. So Sandra Bailey, it was really terrific. It's on Criterion, so you can get it easily. It was actually just recently reissued by them on Blu-ray. So go watch the bailiff named Sancho is my recommendation. Go now, y'all.
Okay. Nick Newman. Or Danny King.
Would you like me to go again?
Yeah. Do you want Nick to go again? Or?
Yeah, you get to take Danny's place.
Okay, cool.
Absolutely not. No. All right. So Danny King, what about yourself?
Yeah, I saw this great movie last night called Emperor of the North.
Okay.
It was directed by Robert Aldrich. And I think I've mentioned Aldrich a couple times, but like the more films I see by him, the more impressed I continue to be. And this film from 1973, just like listen to the premise of it. So it takes place during the Great Depression, and Ernest Borgnine plays like this train manager conductor guy who has a reputation for killing hobos that try to hop his train for free, to get free rides. So like the pre-credit scene is this hobo trying to climb up Ernest Borgnine's train, and Ernest Borgnine pulls a hammer out of his jacket or whatever, and just chucks it at the hobo's face.
Holy shit.
And the hobo like falls off the train and presumably like is very seriously injured, and then there's like the credits. And so the rest of the movie is Lee Marvin and a pretty young Keith Carradine, and they're both like, Lee Marvin is this like older hobo, and he's sort of like very respected as a train hopper, and so he's taking it upon himself to successfully ride Ernest Borgnine's train. And Keith Carradine is like tagging along. And so the whole movie is just on these trains and these men are like fighting each other. And it's really brutal. But Aldrich, he just has a way with violence where you can't like escape it. And it was pretty powerful to see on the big screen. A lot of hammers thrown at people's faces though. So it's disturbing.
All right. Film that I watched this week that I think we should all check out. It's something that I've brought up before, but it is the only thing that I've watched this week, and I love it so much. So, this is Palme d'Or winner, The Tree of Life, directed by Terrence Malick. It was my number one film of 2011, and it is the story of Sean Penn trying to come to terms with the death of his brother many years before.
I thought the movie didn't have a plot.
You would be wrong. Random person who Nick has invented to allegorically fight with me. Yeah, so what was I saying? Sean Penn viewing his life through the continuum and contextualization of the entirety of existence in order to come to a greater understanding about the death of his brother many years before. It is a fantastic film, and it is beautiful and moving, and it's amazing, and you should check it out.
Yeah, that film's well directed.
Very well directed. Unlike Blue is the Warmest Color, it has many shots which on a pure visual level will linger with you far, far into the future. Alright, so that's it. Let's tell the people where you can be found until next week when we'll be talking about The Hunger Games. So, Nick Newman, where can we find you on the internet?
First, I'll be choosing between pasta or oysters. Kind of depends on the situation and if we're talking metaphor or just food. Also, thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And Danny King.
Yes, I will also be at the French cafes with gyro.
Yeah, it's gyro.
Gyro.
See, that's the gender-neutral food. Everybody can agree on gyro.
Yeah, I'll be chowing down on that food item. Also, filmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And you can find me floating listlessly in an ocean, or on twitter.com/BrianJRowan, thefilmstage.com, and my personal blog, dearfilm.net. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much, and join us next week when we'll be talking about The Hunger Games: Catching Fire. Today we'll be reviewing Blue is the Warmest Color, the film by, oh Jesus, I really should have practiced saying his name first, and starring Lea Seydoux and Adele Exarchopoulos. Holy shit. Wow. That was like walking into a brick wall.
a sexy brick wall.
A sexy, sexy brick wall.
Winner of the Palme d'Or.
Palme d'Orgasm, more like it.
Whoa! Save it for the review. Fuck. Jesus.
Okay.
Okay, I just got interrupted here. Palme d'Orgasm, according to Google exact phrase search, has only been used twice.
What? No way. But again, like when you get a, what is happening now?
Oh, sorry, I had to move rooms.